from Akron, Ohio. This is episode 221 of On the Tropes. This week's episode, we are talking about the trope Great Escape. We are going to be talking about prison escape movies, busting out of the pokey, the clink, breaking free. I'm your host, Nick, and joining me today with a cake that has a nail file in it.
I think I'd rather be the wrongfully imprisoned escapee.
You could be both.
Yeah, I think that could work. Maybe I'm coming back in from a work release.
That cake's got to get to us somehow.
Well, anyhow, I'm sir.
And it's just it's a gruesome twosome tonight.
Yeah, it was kind of like when I said it. I think I said it kind of anticipating that there would be an Ann Kyle, or maybe even a Thymo or an Eva. Yeah,
it's just the two of us. We were the only ones who got caught.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a
video. I was going to say,
there's like a really popular co-op game that is just, it's like a two-player game that you're two guys escaping from prison. Maybe No Way Out.
Is it a board game?
We would need Kyle.
Oh, is it a video game?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Anyways, I guess we can preamble the trope before we get to our lists. I feel like it's pretty straightforward, though. I guess we should talk about the prisoners. So there's a couple different flavors that this usually comes in. I feel like for the most part, it's people who are wrongfully imprisoned. Mm-hmm. I guess the two types of people there are people who are wrongfully imprisoned and people who are rightfully imprisoned. And this is usually you want to root for the prisoners in these movies. So they usually have someone who either is wrongfully jailed or is rehabilitated but not being let out, or I've got a couple war prisoner, POW escape movies that are probably going to come up later. But I feel like that comes up a lot too. How do you think the prisoners are usually kind of portrayed in these movies?
Yeah, I think, the trope definitely references the most popular POW film ever. Yet, I definitely think that the typical prison escapee movie protagonist is a guy who is either there and like for some kind of frame up, or is there in Cool Hand Luke due to what we understand to be an overly impressive set of circumstances, environment. Something like that, Cool Hand Luke. Basically, I don't know. Do you have him on your list, by the way?
Maybe it doesn't have to be. Okay, it was going to be, but no, that's fine. Let's talk about it.
I don't want to get too far out of it yet. Basically, the crime that he commits to get in prison is ridiculous.
It's one of the funniest crimes. It's one of the funniest crimes I can think of.
And ultimately, he pays the ultimate price for that. And I think that. And those, spoilers, I guess. Something you said, that there are the wrongfully imprisoned and the rightfully imprisoned. That's where that kind of becomes kind of part of the, I guess, wider story, the culture and the story, the story is set in. Because, in our country, we have, 4,000 felonies, and we used to have way less than that since before the 80s. So it's it kind of sometimes. The context is what's crime, what's really right and wrong. And I think that's what some of these films are really getting at when they give us a protagonist that is there, yet maybe is there because of some environmental pressures and oppression. Or
yeah, and that's part of the reason I had that one on my list, actually, is because it's one of the rare examples. So do you have Shawshank on your list?
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's not on my list either, just because it felt like, of course, Shawshank. Everyone knows about it. I don't need to talk about it. But that's something where, spoilers for a movie that you've all seen. He's innocent. We know he's innocent. So him breaking out is, this sort of redemption that he deserves in, a cosmic sense. Whereas Cool Hand Luke is interesting because he's not innocent. I don't think he deserves... He certainly doesn't deserve, all that happens. He probably doesn't even deserve to be in jail. I would say he's just committing petty vandalism, but he's not totally innocent the way somebody like Andy Dufresne is. So he's in this backdrop where like he deserves like a slap on the wrist of some sort, but he certainly doesn't deserve to be like tortured and imprisoned the way he is.
Yeah.
And I think that that dynamic is really interesting, and it's something that we don't typically see. Like there's a few other like some bank rot, like Out of Sight has some prison escape stuff where like he's a bank robber, he should be in jail, but or like, you know, he deserves some sort of punishment, but still you root for him. And that's much different than rooting for Andy Dufresne, where like of course you're gonna root for him, he yeah. didn't do it
well. And I have to be like completely transparent here, but like philosophically I'm explicitly against prisons, you know. Mm-hmm. Like I'm an abolitionist by philosophy, like I'm against the carceral system. And I think that like there's that question of Cool Hand Luke and what should have happened. I mean, the crime that he commits, you're right, it's one of my favorite crimes, quote unquote, on television, because or on film, because it like it might be one of the purest examples of victimless crime that we have. And it's so cool too, because it might be kind of commenting on it, maybe not might, it is commenting on class.
Oh, just I mean
Luke's mother, his upbringing, you know, this is a guy who is really poor.
So let's just talk about the crime, because I think it's important, like yeah. the symbolism. So he goes to jail for using bolt cutters, big bolt cutters, and cutting off the tops of parking meters.
Yeah.
And you're talking about
not even taking the money.
Yeah. And you're talking about class. And I think maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I like the idea where he is basically cutting off the heads of the parking meters.
Yeah. And that's
and when we think about
not even stealing. That's yeah. One of the key things too, is he's not reaching down and taking the money. He's just taking heads off.
He's being the guillotine of this. Absolutely. Like this, you know, parking meters. Like I don't want to get like, that's going to be like a big tangent can you own the street?
Yeah, exactly. And I think like, maybe we should, let's save it for when it comes up in your list. Cause there's so much more about Cool Hand Luke and,
yeah,
what the movie is really about, him being, you know, the Christ-like element. So of course there's this class element. There's a guy who's attacking. Yeah, you know, maybe we're getting ahead of it. I think like overall, so back to Shawshank, Americans have had a thing about prison reform films since like, I guess it would be I Was a Fugitive on a Chain Gang. Mm-hmm. And that came about, like, prison reform has been this big thing in this country since the Quakers came up with solitary confinement, because they felt like that was actually more humane than they basically just throw you in a dungeon before. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, movies like Fugitive with the Chain Gang came out and there was a big kind of focus on trying to clean up these prisons. I think Shawshank is cool because it's this distillation of all of these prison movies, like Birdman of Alcatraz and like all those kinds of prison escape movies, plus showing the brutality of prison, because that's I think what Shawshank is about, and what I think a lot of prison escape movies are about, are showing kind of how bizarrely oppressive an institution can become and like what the human spirit does in response.
Yeah. And I think on my list, even the things that aren't going to show up, but I mean Shawshank is another, like, it's one of the most defining like triumph of the human spirit movies of the last, like, you know, our lifetimes. I don't know if it still is, but it certainly has been for a long time the number one rated movie on IMDb, which, you know, isn't necessarily like the mark of the best film of all time, but I think it does signify like mass appeal. And it's a movie that's mass appealing. Like so many people really love that movie because it's about, you know, the small guy winning over like this wildly corrupt system. And I think that's what the best of these movies do.
Yeah, and I think America really just seems to have a thing for those kinds of films. Because I'm thinking about how, so I'm looking, 1932 was I'm a Fugitive, you know, National Film Registry, 3 Academy Award nominations, it's Paul Mooney, huge film. And yet it's an explicitly anti-authoritarian film. Mm-hmm. Kind of the same with, you get to 1962, Birdman of Alcatraz, bunch of Academy Awards, bunch of Best Actor, Best Cinematography. Like, it's this weird thing where America has, and this is kind of relevant to me in this new, you know, once again, we have the right explicitly saying Law and Order, which is like one of the biggest dog whistles in American history. Like, any political scientists out there, or just Google it. Like, there's such a story behind that, listeners, like, to use that term. In a country where that is, there's like this love affair with that, there's also this deep cultural obsession with like people breaking out of jail. You know, it's like, and I think that speaks to, there's always kind of like, you know, it's multiple layers of our culture. There's definitely a freedom loving and kind of spirit that I think, as you said, is also to people about this like triumph of the human spirit.
You want to dive into our lists?
Yeah.
What is your number 5?
Let's see. I'll start with Batman, the animated series. And this one was like the first one I thought of. And these are pretty out of order. Yet this is like one of my favorite childhood ones. Basically, it is an episode where Batman, he's like volunteering at basically a homeless shelter. And it's this great episode because it's kind of showing Batman's somewhat like his guilt because he's really rich, you know, and he has this nightmare in the story where all these homeless people are coming up to him and he kind of like can't help all of them. He tries to give him money. So anyhow, he's volunteering there and he hears that a guy was actually kidnapped. One of the volunteers was kidnapped and he starts to investigate. He like goes undercover. It's a really great episode because it's one of the, like when I show people what's great about Batman TAS, this is always one of the episodes I show them because it's Batman being a detective. He goes in disguise and he is investigating this kidnapping and he himself gets kidnapped, hit over the head, gets amnesia, wakes up, and he's in this like very classic prison in the desert kind of trope. Like it's, and what's cool about it, I don't even think the guy running the prison, he's like this huge kind of almost Orson Welles like figure. He's got like a big like sun hat and he's always eating like a chicken wing and has the shotgun. It's like ordering beatings and, you know, I don't even think the dude has a name. Like it's so great. You just know that he's kidnapping people off the streets and he's throwing them in like a solitary confinement box, like a steel box he's got in the middle of the, you know, like the hottest place in the area. And it's a really like fun episode. And because it shows it's Batman without the, utility belt, that trope too. Yet, so basically Bruce Wayne has to escape and there's a lot of good fight scenes and kind of that whole I'm a Fugitive from a Chain Gang thing, like the 30s era prison movies. It's really fun.
If only Batman had the resources to combat
poverty
and homelessness.
Only he could do something like politically or with his billions of dollars.
Yeah, I was going to say with just like the interest on his bank account.
I don't know if I said the episode, The Forgotten Season 1, Episode 23. Nick, what's your number 5?
My number 5 is, we'll just get Cool Hand Luke out of the way. So it's a 1967 drama starring, of course, Paul Newman. And it is a man who goes to jail for petty vandalism, and he ends up kind of staging a revolt against the people who run the prison, to varying degrees of success and failure. It is a movie that I was not forced to watch, but made to watch by contract on this show. And I absolutely loved it. I think it's a fantastic movie. That's a year. The 1967 Oscars are really notable. There's actually even a book just about, like, solely about, like, the Oscars from that year and the ramifications that they had. Because that was the year that the nominees were Bonnie and Clyde, Dr. Dolittle, weird, The Graduate, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and the winner was In the Heat of the Night. Cool Hand Luke did not get nominated for Best Picture, which I think is a terrible decision. And Rod Steiger won for In the Heat of the Night over Paul Newman. He won over Dustin Hoffman. He won over Warren Beatty and Bonnie and Clyde. And he won over Spencer Tracy.
Not to mention, I mean, I just watched that movie, like, because I hadn't seen it since I was a little kid.
In the Heat of the Night.
I think I'd seen that movie probably one time at like 8 years old. I mean, I was really young. So I watched it a few months ago. It was like February. And yeah, I mean, Sidney Poitier is in it enough that he could have gotten a nod there.
Yep. He could have. He maybe should have. As I remember it, Sidney Poitier is the lead and not Rod Steiger, right? Rod Steiger is...
I feel like Sidney Poitier is the lead, yeah.
Rod Steiger is sort of like at most second lead and maybe closer to a supporting?
Yeah.
Maybe. Certainly. You know.
Yeah, I mean, I know an equal amount about both characters. I feel like Sidney gets more time on screen. It's
right.
About him.
Yeah. the
There would be no story really if he hadn't stopped there in that town. So I don't know.
That movie's a little, and I think it's much better made. But it's kind of just a little bit of that Green Book flavor to it, where like all you need is a white guy to like meet a black guy, and then suddenly racism is solved.
Yeah, and
it's better than that. I don't love the movie, but it's certainly better than Green Book.
However, there's like the ending where basically it's found out that, I mean, the town is never called to task for their extreme racism. That's the thing. It just kind of ends with, oh yeah, you know, this person was really the shooter. Okay, everybody's still racist and horrible, and we're about to try to lynch Sidney Poitier, a cop.
Yeah.
A figure of authority in total open anarchy and, you know, lawlessness. They're going to just kill this guy. Yet, you know, whatever. I mean, we caught the guy. So,
yeah. Story. I do think it's a fine movie. It's just, it's funny that that's something that, like, is and has been a trope for a very long time. But Green Book has problems beyond just the politics of it. It's a terribly made and terribly written film. So its problems do not stop and start and stop with its facile view of race relations and politics in this country. But anyways, huge tangent. Cool Hand Luke, pretty rad movie. Paul Newman is what some would say a good actor. Some would even say a great actor.
Pretty good.
I would say that as well.
Oh man. Yeah, we didn't really start talking about Cool Hand Luke.
Yeah. Well, we've already kind of talked about it quite a bit already.
You know, the explicit like Christ overtones. I mean, he's completely socialist. Because he's just cutting, like you said, it's the guillotine. He's taking the heads off the commerce and the banking system. He's flipping the tables.
It's one of my favorite Christ allegories in film.
It's as good as Starman. Only Starman is a cruel, in my opinion, Starman is a great Christ allegory because he's not saying anything important.
I'm not a fan of Starman. Have we talked about this on the show?
Yeah, and I loved it when I was a kid, and I watched it again. And I watched it under the same conditions that I watched Spaceballs, and I was like, This is the most empty film that has it thinks it's saying a lot, and yet if you really listen to anything he says, it's the most empty dialogue. And I think it might be intentional. Like, I want to believe that there's like kind of a tongue-in-cheek attack on like these religious figures in there, like the men from the sky. Yeah, whatever.
I think they just didn't nail it. There's I don't want to talk about. I don't want to go off on another tangent.
we don't want to curse this episode.
Yeah. Anyways, Cool Hand Luke, pretty good movie. Very Cool Hand Luke. That's what they should be called, because it's a very cool movie. Sir, what is your number four?
So my number four, I'm going to go with the series Female Prisoner Scorpion, starring Miko Keiji. And I probably just butchered her name. She was the star of Lady Snowblood. She had a great career over there, just being like really badass gangsters. And
what is this called? I want to look it up.
So the Female Prisoner Scorpion series. It starts with Female Prisoner Scorpion. Female Prisoner 701 Scorpion.
Scorpion. Okay.
And then Female Prisoner 701 Jailhouse 41 is more of the Prison Break one. Yet, you know, you may as well watch the first one too. They're fun. You know, there's a lot of I'm sure listeners have noticed by now I'm talking about a women in prison film, and this is a storied genre, much maligned for good reason. Yet within every genre, there's just those films that like completely rise above. And man, are these movies badass. Like, as gangster films, they are so fun. Like, she's just one of the greatest like tough actors in from her era in the 70s, like especially Japanese actors. And a lot of great fights. Like, there's knife fights and, you know, cruel guards and revenge, a lot of revenge. I can't really say enough good things about him. Like, and it's, and like I said, it's buried in a genre that's mostly just terrible. Yeah. They're good movies. They're fun. There's about four of them. Scorpion, Jailhouse 41, Be Stable, and then Grudge Song.
Okay. I was looking this up. My 2017 list of best movies for first time watches. Number five was Daughters of the Dust. My number three was Lady Snowblood.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Yeah. And this one it's like modern era. It's just, and it's fun. It's her just playing a complete gangster.
Nice. I will have to check that out for sure.
It for a while was some of them were on Criterion for a bit. I don't know if they still are though. I would check there for sure. Nick, what is your number four?
My number four is a movie called, the full title is A Man Escaped or The Wind Bloweth Where It Listeth, apparently. But I think most people just know it as A Man Escaped, which is a Robert Bresson movie from 1946. And it is about a man who I think it takes place in French-occupied or German-occupied France during World War II. And the protagonist is a French resistance member who gets arrested by the Germans, and he is thrown in jail. And the entire movie is just about him trying to escape, as the title alludes to. And it's a really cool movie. It's really just a process movie where all you do, and I think this was attributed to the director, is the saying that action is, I think what he said was action is character. So really all, like, you don't get to know much about this guy's backstory, or he's not like trying to get home to his wife and child. You just find yourself being attached to him and interested in his escape and his success, because the entire movie you're just seeing him trying to do it. And that is what gets you enwrapped in this guy's story. It's a really cool movie. It's probably my favorite of his movies. He's got a really interesting style of filmmaking. It's very like stripped down and bare. He almost always uses non-professional actors. But I think this is my favorite of the movies that he has made that I've seen. It's just, you're just watching a dude break out of prison for an hour and a half and planning and ultimately escaping. It's a cool movie.
Nice.
What is your, go ahead.
Well, French prison escape film. I was like, I mean, have you seen Papillon?
I haven't. I am going to talk about another French escape, prison escape movie in a little bit though. Huh. But I haven't seen Papillon.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I should. Well, I'm just going to talk about it real quick. It's great. Stephen Queen, Dustin Hoffman. And it's like, for 1973, it's a remarkably non, like, you know, I was just talking about how great Miko Kaji is. It's like a just total badass character. Stephen Queen at that time was like the one of the toughest guys in the world as far as anybody was concerned, right? Mm-hmm. And Papillon, he's not that. Like, he's just very much a guy who is like, he's tough, yet he's not intimidating. He's not like a badass, quote unquote. He's more just a guy who's resilient and relentless in his pursuit of getting out of there. Yet. So yeah, that's my runner up to random number three runner up. I'm going to go with a Star Trek episode called The Hunted. And so this is Star Trek The Next Generation, season 3, episode 11, and stars James Cromwell, is it, which is cool. And basically, the Enterprise shows up on this planet, and, you know, it seems like it's like this utopia, and basically, a guy beams onto their ship and kind of tries to, like, take over and is, like, running amok, and they sap him, and he's like got these, he's kind of genetically enhanced, and they end up capturing him and finding out that he escaped from a prison on that planet. And his whole story is that he's a former prison. Basically he was part of a genetically engineered group of soldiers that when their violent tendencies were like, they couldn't be reversed. They basically were just all imprisoned. And it's this whole thing, like a lot of TNG episodes were extended like diplomatic dramas, the just figuring out how is the culture of this superhumane culture of the Federation going to deal with these very complex societies they might run into. And, you know, James Cromwell is like the leader of the group of people. And his thing is basically, hey, we did what we had to do, to maintain like peace and order. And it ends up that the prisoner escapes the ship, goes back to the planet, and starts to engineer a coup. And they're like, hey, like the Federation, you got to help us. And they're like, no, we don't. Like, you know, this is kind of, you brought this on yourself. This is like a logical, what comes out of this kind of thing, and try to treat people more humanely, basically. And then hopefully we'll work it out. Yeah. It's just a great episode and kind of an example of like these really deep kind of social and political ideas that the Next Generation just, ever, you know, they've really tried to talk about it.
Did you say James Cromwell, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Question for you, without looking it up, where is James Cromwell from? What country is he from?
Oh man, just a guess.
Yeah,
I would say because I'm thinking of LA Confidential, some other movies. Is he Scottish? Maybe.
He's American.
He's totally American.
He's American. I was shocked to learn that. I thought, wow. I thought 100% I would have bet my house that he was
Australian. Probably like from Iowa or something.
I thought for sure he was from Australia. Maybe because like Babe and he made that with George Miller, I guess. I don't know. I was convinced that I knew for a fact. Like I thought I had heard it and it was just something that everybody knew. James Cromwell is Australian. No, he's American.
He's American and he's from LA.
That's as American as it gets.
Yeah.
He's also, absolutely. I think he's also like a very, he's 6'6".
Yeah.
He's a tall drink of water.
That dude's huge.
Yeah. He's 80. Good for him, man.
Wow.
What a, because he didn't really kind of blow up in the public zeitgeist, I think, until like Babe. So 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. But since then, like, man, he's had one heck of a career.
Yeah, I'd like to go over some of his early films. Some interesting stuff here. I mean, none of them are like, they're all bit parts. Mm-hmm. He's in Revenge of the Nerds.
That movie has some issues. Let's not talk about them, but there are some issues.
Also, with
that.
Revenge of the Nerds too.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, it sure does. Also, real quick, in Revenge of the Nerds, he was credited as Jamie Cromwell.
He does not look like a Jamie, no. Gotta say.
No.
But yeah, since like in the 80s, he has all these bit parts, and then in the 90s, just like boom, Star Trek, boom, LA Confidential, boom.
Yeah, 1995, Babe.
Babe 2, Deep Impact, The Green Mile, Space the Cowboys. Yeah, these are all like, these are some big movies. Dante's Inferno.
Species 2.
I, Robot. Now we can see him in...
Spider-Man 3.
He's in Succession now.
Yeah, it's weird because one other actor has had... He's got a lot of really like highly respected films and then some of the most panned films.
Yeah.
There's like a huge swing here.
I think he's a great actor, though.
Mm.
He's really, really good.
Your number three?
My number three, well, speaking of Steve McQueen, and you mentioned this was a first time viewing for me this year. But I'd never seen The Great Escape until this year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I don't know how. It is a 1963 World War II movie starring Steve McQueen, James Garner, Richard Attenborough. Pretty much like it was a really who's who of like the guys from like the 50s, 60s era. It is about tons of guys, like dozens of guys who are in a POW camp during World War II in Germany, being run by the Nazis. And many of these men have escaped from prisons already. So they kind of like, it's just the Ocean's 11 of prison escape teams. They all get together. Everyone has distinct roles and they try to get out.
That's like the most fun aspect of that film that I think is lost somehow. Mm-hmm. Like, I think if you just tell people that part of it, oh, it's a POW camp made up of all the prisoners who've escaped other camps. You can sell anything. Like you could, that's just, it's perfect. Yet I think the movie's so long that some of the pop of their personalities is almost like weirdly obscure, is like lost in it because it's such a long movie that
it's incredibly, it's just shy of 3 hours. But I do have to say, it doesn't, I don't think it feels that long. I think it feels like a 2 hour long movie. It, because I mean, every time you look around, it's like, oh, there's Charles Bronson, there's Donald Pleasance.
It's no, just you're
so,
right.
It's so many people that we know and love. I had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, I watched it like it was late last year, and I thought that I did think like, wow, this actually is really like still really exciting. Mm-hmm. Like it's just still a really thrilling film, and it is kind of what you're saying, where every few scenes you've got another just incredible actor, and you're kind of like, oh, what's this person doing? You know, and I guess I can kind of remember a specific thing about each character. You know, Steve McQueen, he has the motorcycle.
Throwing the baseball against the wall.
Yeah, you know, he's the American, the hotshot. Charles Bronson, he's afraid of, you know, he's the guy who digs tunnels. Yeah, he's claustrophobic. Mm-hmm. Those two British guys, you know, they're cheeky. Always getting the best of the Nazis.
Yeah, I really liked it. It's like one of the movies that I felt like as a father, I need to like, that's a very much like dad movie. That's like a canonical dad movie. So yeah. I needed to finally get that off of my blind spot list.
Yeah, definitely. It's a good holiday film.
Yeah. What's your number two?
Number two, you know, I was thinking of like different fantasy escapes, and the best one is, oh my god, and Nick, you got to get to the end of The Last Airbender, because
I watched
Korra.
Yeah, I watched an episode yesterday, so I'm three episodes into season two
of Airbender.
So I still have a ways to go, but I picked it back up.
Cool. Yeah, because I mean, Legend of Korra is just it's so cool after watching Airbender, because you really get to see the progression. Like, for once, it's a fantasy story that shows you, hey, this is how the world would progress in like 200 years or however long it is. And there's this great moment where it's set over a few episodes where the villains of a certain season, there are these like four really dangerous benders, and they're all locked in a maximum security prison that's like suited just for them. So the earthbender is in the middle of the ocean. It's entirely made out of wood. It's like there's nothing around him that he could use. The waterbender is situated directly above a volcano. The firebender's in like the Arctic. And then there's a guy who's like a metal bender, essentially. He's like in this huge mountain. Mm-hmm. It's just like really cool. Like, it's in the, basically one of them, there's like a terrorist guy who's trying to free each one of them. So he has to go and break him out. And there's like a hyper secretive order that is in charge of prisons. That's like all they do. It's just like one of the coolest fantasy examples of the trope. And then Korra is just like, Legend of Korra is brilliant. The Avatar is great. Like, Avatar Last Airbender is really great. And I think they're both equally like, Korra does everything right as a series, because it's not trying to be what the Airbender was. I mean, I think the coolest thing about The Last Airbender to me is that it's probably the only fantasy story that really competes with the epic feel, like hero's journey feel that like Lord of the Rings has. Mm-hmm. Things like that. Whereas I would say Korra is one of the best social political commentaries like we have from that kind of genre. It's just so fun. But Nick, what is your number two? And like, there's a bunch of commentary real quick just about like, why are these people in prison? What were they trying to accomplish, and what's wrong, whether it's right or wrong? It's really cool. But what is your number two?
My number two, I'm also going to go with like ostensibly not really a child's property, but it's kind of like in the similar vein to, I think, Legend of Korra or Avatar, how it's like appealing to kids, but also appealing to adults, because it's tackling bigger themes. And it's a movie I've talked about a million times. It is Paddington 2. It stars Paddington Brown, the bear, who is wrongfully imprisoned in the sequel because he is framed for the theft of a pop-up book. And he befriends some of the criminals in the prison due to his marmalade-making skills. People, especially like the scariest guy in the prison, played by Brendan Gleeson, sort of takes him under his wing after he discovers that Paddington makes incredible marmalade. And they decide to hatch an escape. And Paddington does a really good job of kind of tackling this theme of like wrongful imprisonment. I mean, really, it is a wrongful imprisonment movie. And then there are also touches of like prison reform in it, where when he gets in there, it's kind of like brutal, and the guards are mean to him, like it's still towards children. Like they're not,
they're not like breaking his toes or anything.
No, no. They tell him like he can't get a bed. They tell him he can't like get a bedtime story, but yeah. Like still the metaphor stands. And then he sort of comes in and helps turn things around, but still the prisoners decide that they want to escape. So they, you know, engineer their prison escape through a series of there's like Modern Times, the Chaplin movie. There's like a visual allegory to that during their escape with like the gears, like, you know, the picture, the like,
oh yeah, of
Charlie
yeah.
Chaplin going through the gears, like Paddington goes through the gears, and then they end up breaking out through a hot air balloon. But it's a really like the way it's shot is really interestingly done, because it has sort of like a dollhouse appearance to when they first break out, where you see all the different rooms like as if the building has been cut down the middle, so you're looking at all the separate prison cells at once. So it's a really cool sequence. It's just such a fun movie. It's just an utter delight, and I'm gonna use every opportunity to bring it up. So
Paddington, I should probably watch those two. You know, I should probably finally get around to it.
They're really good.
You know, I kept hearing the kind of Legion Impossible, like it being like an immigration story.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's I mean, he is an immigrant because he's from Peru, and there's a character who in the second one sort of takes on like this, like clearly would have been a leave / Brexit type. Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the characters gets to make a speech about how you never liked him, but he, you know, like the sort of uplifting speech where if you think about it even for a second, you're like, oh, this is clearly about Brexit, and like judge people on their actual character and not based on like where they're from or who they yeah. are. And it's one of those things, like, you know, as adults we don't necessarily need to hear that from a movie to know that it's true, but it's just nice to see it in this way. And it's nice that, you know, it's a fun movie that you can, like, my 3-year-old likes it, she's watched it tons of times, and it's a message that, I mean, if she needs to get it from the movie, then like clearly I'm doing something wrong. But it's but it's nice that there's something else that's like, hey, like the things that I'm trying to teach you are like coinciding with this, instead of like,
oh yeah,
you know, some
I mean the federal government, you know.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, like it's, I'm sure we should know it as adults. Like, well, you mentioned like we as adults maybe don't need to hear.
I guess should, yeah, is the maybe.
I think if there's anything that the last few years has shown us, is that yeah, maybe we do need these things. I mean, yeah. I
specifically meant like you and I.
Yeah.
There are a lot of movies that I think maybe if people were forced to watch, the world and the nation would be a better place. But
I think it's huge for kids too. Like I got a lot out of that kind of positive reinforcement. You know, that, I mean, I brought up a lot of things today that, like Star Trek, that's a movie that definitely that's a show that my dad would sit us down and talk to us about. Hey, what about a world where there's no currency, where they just kind of like everybody has their needs met, where they use technology to kind of take care of people, and what comes out of that? Maybe it's a place like this. Even Fugitive with the Chang Dang and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Those are all films that were those that kind of positive reinforcement for the stuff I was hearing. I think that the older I get, the more I'm convinced of how important like science and ethics based morality based and social based like stories are, like stories about how people get along in a way that's healthy, is good. We don't have enough of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I think this is a really good one.
Now we're really old.
Yeah. What is your numero uno?
So my number one is a real life example. It is the escape of Assata Shakur, the former Black Panther, Black Liberation Army, Black Power Movement activist from the 70s, former student, and well, graduate, and just an intellectual and scholar, poet. She was extremely active in the 70s Black Power Movement. She did a lot of the food programs. So, like, listeners might have heard me talk about it before. Yeah. Things like the, like, how we have even ambulances, like food in schools, a lot of people know that comes from the Black Panthers. Like, children having breakfast comes directly from the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. Also, things like, like ambulances, though, and like things like building, like a lot of the building codes, like around like federal housing and things like that, and having superintendents and things like that. Like, there was a lot of stuff that they fought for, and because they were doing for tenants, like they used to go and do like pest control, that later the government like picked up, or nonprofits did, and then later the government did. So she was really active in those kinds of survival programs, they call them. And then there, she got caught up in some beef with the government, as the kids say. And that turned into a statewide manhunt. And she was then arrested, charged with murder, attempted murder, armed robbery, bank robbery, all that stuff. And a group of, it was four BLA members, including Mutulu Shakur, who is Tupac's uncle, they broke her out. They kind of like were like acting like they were visiting, and they snuck in some pistols and a stick of dynamite, seized two correction officers, got a van, got her in it, took her to the Bahamas. So she's in Cuba to this day. She's,
oh, wow.
It's a really incredible story. Like, the, I think
what's
a
lot of the,
so this is Assata Shakur. She's still on the FBI's most wanted list. Every once in a while, like Republican politicians, like Chris Christie, will bring her up in campaigns. I think Trump too has made threats against Cuba. That's been one of the long standing.
What? That doesn't issues. Sound like, that doesn't sound like something he would do.
Oh yeah. You know, and so, and keep in mind too that like she was being defended by William Kunstler at the time. There was a great deal of skepticism about whether or not the charges by the state were correct. Of course, there was at the time numerous people assassinated, and there was a kind of a much more hot political situation in the country, and many people were being imprisoned on political for political reasons, and I think it's really relevant now as we are like heading into a situation where we're dealing with a more outwardly authoritarian U.S. Because I think what's interesting, a lot of listeners, like a lot of young people I know, grew up with Obama, so they had, like, they don't remember Bush, they don't remember like any of that stuff. Like, it's kind of routine for the U.S. to kind of have really authoritarian.
I've heard so many people in the last like couple years, but I feel like over the last few months I've been hearing it more and more that, like, oh, I hate Trump so much. I don't like so and so. I don't like Biden, but I would even take Bush over Trump. And I'm like, we may just now be getting to the point where Trump is actually worse than Bush in terms of like stuff that he's caused. And like,
we're, yeah, I see what you mean.
Like, in a tangible sense.
It's like, and which is unbelievable to even say it. I do think that, yeah, you're right, that we have maybe in the last year, he's gotten to the point where it's like, oh,
wow. Yeah. And it's tough to say, like, to what degree, like, trying to compare, like, just the dog whistling and the shit that he says and the undemocratic things to, like, the literal cost of like human life that you can actually see.
He's a torture alone.
Yeah, he's going up against the Iraq War. Like that's a tough thing to top in terms of like pure evil.
And I think the torture thing is the other big thing.
Yeah, he's getting pretty close if he hasn't surpassed it at this point. But to say like
he surpassed it for sure.
Yeah. But to say like, man, the good old days when George W. Bush was president, it's like, yeah, maybe here. Maybe for us, but there are other places in the world that I'm gonna say would disagree with you.
Yeah, it's definitely like we've had some real sketchy Republican presidents this last few runs, and you know, and that's what's even more shocking is that somehow somehow people were like, hey, you know what? Let's make this, let's make them even more explicitly fascist.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't enough already. I don't know. But, you know, and I don't want to get too much into, you know, the quote unquote politics, as they say it. I think even that is it's impossible not to in this current environment. And I hope people are realizing that like we're getting to a point where, everything will be made into politics when you have a government that's trying to explicitly keep, you know, suppress freedom of speech and playing after the press and all these over the top things.
Well, that's something that I've like had to grapple with myself, just like over the last few years, is that I was able to, like not be that cognizant of things just out of laziness and privilege. And it's interesting being forced to like, you know, I'm trying to be, I also have like a little bit more time cause I'm out of school and everything, to like pay closer attention to things. But man, like I missed a lot of stuff that was significant that I wish I would have paid closer attention to.
Some stuff's gone down.
Yeah. Some real shit has happened. Anyways, back to something like a little bit less serious, although it's a serious movie. It's just not a real life person for my number one.
Yeah.
But my number one, this is another first watch for me, and this is really up there. Like it's probably like top five-ish of my favorite movies that I've seen for the first time this year. And it is another French war movie. This one is from 1937, so just before like World War II, by Jean Renoir, and it is called The Grand Illusion. And it is about a group of French soldiers in World War I who are captured by the Germans. So this is about World War I, but it's taking place like just at the dawn of World War II. And it's basically about these French soldiers. And it's really similar in a lot of ways, like on its surface, to something like The Great Escape, where they're just trying to get out and they're not even being treated that badly in a sense where like you don't see them being tortured. But there is like in The Great Escape, you know, solitary confinement and people are in prison and they're still in prison. And one of the worries, I don't remember how much it is in this, but certainly in The Great Escape, there is fear that like you're going to get killed in prison. Like it's at some point during the war, you're just going to be executed. And I don't remember how much of that there is in this movie, but regardless, like this much smaller group compared to The Great Escape of soldiers decide that they're going to try to break out. And, you know, I won't spoil it from there, but what I really like about this movie is a few things, like the camaraderie between the soldiers is done in a really interesting way, but not just the soldiers like on the French side, but Eric von Stroheim plays the German captain, and he actually befriends like one of the higher ranking members of the French army. And they form like this really kind of bizarre, but touching friendship because they're both like they're both high-ranking officers in their various armies, and even though they're fighting on opposite sides of the war, they form this like very unlikely friendship that kind of comes to a head in a like a really interesting way. I don't want to give away too much about what happens, but I've never seen anything quite like how this plays out. It's a really good movie.
I want to check it out. It's really cool.
It's on and off Criterion. That's where I saw it initially, and then it pops up, or it goes off, and then it pops back up. So if it's not on there now, it'll probably be on there in a couple months. But it's a really good movie. It's just another, like, it's a very triumph of the human spirit movie. But it also, like, it's Renoir, so he's tackling a lot of other issues. Like, he tackles class, and like one of the soldiers is Jewish, so they're talking about anti-Semitism, which is another interesting thing to tackle on the precipice of World War II.
1937.
And really, like, this movie is about just war as hell, and like, you see how these soldiers could get along. Like, they would be buds, they would be dudes if they didn't happen to be fighting on the opposite sides of a war. So it's like just a great humanist film. I really, really adored this movie. So that is The Grand Illusion by John Renoir.
Yeah, it looks really cool. Like, I guess that's the title is alluding to this book, The Great Illusion, about basically how war is futile because of the common economic interests of just regular people. So
it's one of the movies, like, I liked it so much that I have seen, like, I went and tracked down a couple of those other movies that I've watched this year that I hadn't seen before, just because this one was like, it put me on such a high that I'm like, all right, I need to chase this and see some more of his stuff, because I'd only seen Rules of the Game before that from him. So very good movie. I love, so after watching that and The Great Escape this year, I'm like, man, this is just a trope that I really like.
Yeah, there's some good ones. I think you'd really like Papillon too.
I need to check that out. That's good. Is that on Criterion right now?
I don't know if it is.
I'll find it somewhere. It's a well-known movie. It is not, it doesn't look like, but I'll find it anyways. Yeah, so that was, there's a lot of movies that we didn't get into. I'm glad, because I was trying to find one through like the stuff that I've watched recently. I'm glad that you were able to find a couple examples of female prison escapes, because almost always these are, they're dad movies. They're bro. It's like a bunch of bros. They're escaping prison, and you know, that's like part of the key of the dad movies, is it's just dudes having dude friendships, and there aren't any women. Like, I'm trying to think if like Grand Illusion, I think, has one woman. Does The Great Escape have any women, like, with names in it? I'm pretty sure
it has any women at all. Like, I mean, there's women that are like when Stephen Queen's running from the Nazis, like through a like around like trains and civilization. I think there's women in the background.
Yeah. That's what a lot of these movies are. So I'm glad you were able to come in with a couple, because I came up totally empty in that regard. So if you have your own prison escape movies that we didn't mention, you can send them to us at onthetropes@gmail.com. You can follow us on facebook.com/onthetropes or on Twitter @onthetropes. And you can find more about Great Escape at tvtropes.org. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/onthetropes, and you can buy some loot at onthetropes.redbubble.com. Was that everything? That was a lot of stuff.
I think that's everything. Yeah,
we have a lot to plug.
Definitely.
As always, I've been your host, Nick.
I've been Sir.
And stay safe out there, folks. Don't shake hands.
Wear a mask.
Wear a mask, you ding dong.
Mm-hmm.